Squad.
The street's been waiting on this six.
Hello, everybody. I am here with B, the anonymous author of Prol.info, which hopefully our listeners are familiar with. I often reference it as the best source of agitprop propaganda from an ultra-left or anarchist perspective to give to coworkers because it's very smart and very simple and nicely illustrated and designed. Probably abolish restaurants is the one that you might be the most familiar with, but we'll be talking about some of his other work as well, but mainly talking about what is happening in his current country of residence, Spain. So good morning, B. ¿Cómo estás?
Hello. Sobreviviendo. Surviving.
Mm. Yeah, so you live in Madrid?
I live in Valencia.
Oh, you live in Valencia. Okay.
I did live in Madrid, but I've moved to Valencia just this year.
Oh, wow. So you really got a firsthand experience of the flooding that's happened over the last month.
I did. My house did not flood, but not far from where I live was flooded, yes.
Yeah, so what was the area that was hit the hardest? It was more the outer city or the marginal neighborhoods?
So mostly it was the areas south of the city. There were it's kind of like suburbs and small villages that are south of the city.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like hundreds of people have died in the region.
I think it's about 215 confirmed deaths so far, but they're still missing people. Mm-hmm. So it's the worst natural disaster tragedy in Spain since the 60s. There was a big flood then in Catalonia somewhere where over 600 people died. But yeah, it's pretty bad.
So this was not a usual event.
So Valencia and Catalonia, this area of Spain, like the East Coast, it does flood, and there's a record of floods going back to, you know, there's Roman dams here, and the Caliphate was creating water management systems and medieval records of floods. So it's a thing that happens occasionally in this part of Spain. The thing that happened this time, they call it a Dana, Depresión Aislada en Niveles Altos. It's just a bunch of rain falls. It has some sort of meteorological phenomena I don't quite understand. But apparently it's a thing that happens all the time in the fall in the Mediterranean.
And it's different than El Niño and La Niña. I remember that from from the 90s or 2000s. Remember that?
I do remember. I think it's still happening, El Niño, La Niña.
But that's a very
it's different. It's a Mediterranean thing.
Right.
So this time, if you go back in the history of floods in Valencia, there was a big flood in 1957 where 81 people died and there were thousands of houses destroyed. And, you know, that was back when Spain was under Francisco Franco. So it was like a military dictatorship. And Franco visited the city and then they made this big thing called Plan Sur, Plan South, where they diverted the river out of the center of Valencia. And the river now goes south of the city. Most of the time it's just completely empty, a bit like the Los Angeles River. And then it all gets diverted into agriculture. And now in the middle of the city, we have a park with bike lanes and it's in the shape of a river and it's quite nice. But it means that now the Valencia doesn't flood so bad, but when there is one of these things, it all goes south. So all the areas south of the city were hit pretty bad.
And there's a pretty huge industrial agricultural zone south of Valencia, right?
All around Valencia, there's a lot of agriculture. Yeah, there's also a protected wetlands down there that's been hit. The ecological stuff is a bit scary. I went down to help clean up a little bit, and it smells a bit like manure. And I keep getting these warnings on my phone that say, if you're helping out cleaning up the mud from the, or if you've been in contact with flood water, be careful if you show any of these signs. And it's like your eyes start bleeding, your skin turns yellow. So apparently there's some nasty stuff in the in the flood waters.
Do you think that's from like agricultural chemical contamination?
Possibly dead animals. There's also been, I think it's like 130,000 cars were destroyed. It's a massive number of cars were destroyed. So there's also just cars floating around and a big The government seems most worried about bacterial infections.
Okay.
I don't know.
So I'm going to play a little bit of a video of the U.S. coverage of this just for some flavor.
Government's actions under the extreme circumstances. This latest protest coming days after another storm hit Malaga down the Mediterranean coast, the area getting 3 inches of rainfall, or what would normally be nearly a month's worth of rain in just over an hour, submerging the streets in water, according to the country's meteorological agency.
Otra de las vistas que tenemos aquí del río Guadalmedina son las 4:30 de la tarde. Y esto ya está full.
The storm prompted the evacuation of just over 3,000 people, according to the region's government. They've since been permitted to return. The constant barrage leading to anger, frustration, calls for accountability, and revealing the simmering distrust for leaders amid a political divide in the country. After the first flood last month, residents of the worst affected city, Paiporta, attacked King Felipe's motorcade and pelted him with mud during his visit. Then protesters filled squares calling for new leadership.
Regional government didn't warn on time for the flooding, didn't respond on time, didn't get the help from the central government on time, and they just did everything that they could wrong.
This woman in Catarroja saying the death toll didn't have to be so high.
Hemos venido porque no nos saltó una alarma que se tuvo que haber dado y que hubiese podido salvar muchas vidas.
Communities now hoping for some refuge, as extreme weather alerts have mostly been downgraded. But more rain and thunderstorms are expected, as a battered region hopes to recover. Steve Patterson, NBC News.
All right, so I just thought that might be interesting to start off the conversation, because obviously we have these catastrophic weather events in the United States. We had two really massive hurricanes in the last couple months. One really devastating the areas of North Carolina and Appalachia, and then another one ripping through Florida, like one after another. And there's always some sort of political interpretation of this. Obviously, people who are more plugged in and on the left thinking about climate crisis see this as being a global phenomenon of catastrophe caused by global warming and like the inability of international industrial capital to rein itself in and reduce carbon emissions. And that's like a sort of simple way of understanding it that seems to be more or less accurate. But then, of course, the people that affect experience it firsthand tend to be thinking about, well, now my car is gone, now my house is gone, why wasn't there anything done to prevent this? And like, what's going to happen to me now? Can I rely on anyone in the state to help me? And so that's why I think the most resonant images in the United States have been an angry mob throwing mud at the King of Spain. You know, we don't often think about the King of Spain in the United States. Maybe you don't think about the King of Spain much in Spain either. But yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about this royal visit to the devastated region and how that's been interpreted in amongst people, you know, in Valencia.
Okay, well, I have to just take one step back there, because sure. in Spain is divided up into like what are sort of the equivalent of states. They're called autonomous communities, and they have, there's 17 of them in Spain. Valencia City is a city, but Valencia Autonomous Community is one of the big important sort of regions of Spain. And the leader of the president of the autonomous community, it's kind of the equivalent of like a governor in the United States, but they have quite a lot of authority. So for example, we have free public health care here, but a lot of the public health care is managed by the autonomous community. And same thing with public education, and same thing with a lot of the daily life, cultural things. So a lot of the anger is against this guy, Carlos Mazón, or Mazón, who is the president of Valencia. And he's from the conservative party here, the PP. So what happened on the day of the, I mean, there's a number of things. First, what you say about global warming is definitely true. And that's definitely at the basis of these damas. There's been some studies by European scientists that with hotter Mediterranean sea temperatures, these kinds of massive rainfalls are going to be more common and more severe. And just like to give this particular one, they beat the all-time rainfall record in an hour. It was something ridiculous. It was, I think it was 184 liters of water fell per square meter fell in a town in the mountains near here. So it was just ridiculous. So we got something like somewhere between 1 and 2 years of rain in 8 hours. And that kind of increased craziness in the climate is definitely related to global warming. Now, that said, there's the whole question of when the alerts came. So the meteorological agency in Spain warned about, put an orange alert out at like 6:45 in the morning, I think. The port of Valencia, which is one of the big important trade ports of Spain, shut down at 7, so like 20 minutes later. Then it went to a red alert, which is where you're supposed to cease all activities around 7:30, 7:45, something like that. And they were already starting to rescue people from towns in the mountains around 10 or 11. Carlos Masson, who's the president of Valencia, gave a press conference at 1 saying, oh, the storm's going to dissipate by 6 p.m. And by 7, the floods were everywhere. And then eventually by 8, I think it was 8:15 or 8:10, something like that, they actually sent out the alarm. So one of the big criticisms of his government was that he sent out the alarms quite late. There's a picture of a guy holding up a cell phone with an alarm, like standing in floodwaters that an artist did. So that's one of the reasons that everyone's so angry at Masson. And those protests that we saw there, there was over 130,000 people went to the center, and the main demand was that this guy resign, Masson. Mm-hmm. Now, right after the floods, the first night there wasn't much you could do. There was floods everywhere. About a day and a half, 2 days, the floodwaters had gone down a bit, and immediately tens of thousands of people started just marching south because the areas that flooded are all walking distance to Valencia. It's a few kilometers. I biked south and just going south and trying to help out. So for 2 or 3 days, literally tens of thousands of people were walking down with water, with bread, with diapers, with shovels, with brooms, and just going down to try to help out, clean up, see if they could, if people didn't have food or water, and just help out. So then I believe it was the third day or the fourth day after the King of Spain and Sanchez, the president who's socialist, went down to the affected areas. I believe they went to Paiporta, which is the place with the highest death toll. And in order to do that, they cut off the bridges and the police blocked traffic so that they could go do their photo op. So people were so angry because there have been, literally tens of thousands of people walking down every day to help out. They're like, no, the king and the president have to do a photo op. And so, yeah, people started shouting asesino, murderer at him and throwing mud at him. There's a great image of this woman like covered in mud with like gloves on and a broom who's been sweeping mud, and the queen's there trying to console her. And you can see the woman just wants to slap her, but she can't because you go to jail for hitting the king.
And one of the slogans one of the slogans that people were yelling was like, we're covered in mud, you're covered in blood. Something like that.
I didn't hear that, but I like that.
I'm sure it rhymes some other way in Spanish. It was a nice translation by the US media.
That is a good translation. No, I didn't hear that. During the protest, I saw, I didn't go to the protest, but during the protest, I saw that the crowds were chanting, because when they got government building, everyone was just smearing mud because they marched up from the affected areas. And so the mud has kind of become a symbol of people who are trying to help out. So they were just smearing mud, writing Masson resign in mud on the city hall. And then the riot police formed a line in front of that. And everyone started chanting, where were you on the first day? Where were you on the first day? Because the government response, now the army's there and the police are there and they seem to be doing some things, at least with heavy machinery. But for the first couple of days, it was just volunteers going down to help out.
Yeah, so I want to transition this a little bit into talking about Trump and like this concept of the anti-incumbency bias in global politics. We can wrap up talking about Spain for a bit first. So was these protests the result of long simmering tensions against Masson, and then also Masson has blamed it on the more centralized leadership, which is under the PSOE, the Socialist Party. From afar, it just seems like the way this has been kind of politically metabolized is like blaming one representative or another for the lateness of the warnings. Do you feel like that it's been kind of channeled into the prior kind of political discourse in the country, in the region, or is this, does this reflect a more organic reputation of regional government?
That's a good question. I haven't lived in Valencia that long. Valencia is very much of a blue, meaning it's the conservative party who tends to win here. Although the previous government before the election last year was the Socialist Party, Socialist Workers Party. I mean, there's a lot of political things happening with it. So it used to be the socialists in coalition with a left Valencian party and then a further left party, Podemos and Compromís. And they had, one of the things they did was there was some minor flooding back then, and they created an agency which was supposed to coordinate between different agencies in case of an emergency. And then when the PP, the Conservative Party, and Vox, the far-right party, got into government. So the PP is the head, but they're in coalition with Vox. One of the things that Vox demanded was that they eliminate this emergency response thing. So that's a lot of like political capital has been made out of that, because they eliminated this and now this disaster was dealt with so badly. I'm not sure. It seems like it was sort of a coordinating thing between the army and the firefighters. I'm not sure how much of a difference it would have made, but it is. It does. It looks bad, at least. Mm-hmm. So since the protests and the flood, different parties have done different things. Masson has tried blaming various different people. He blamed Sanchez, the socialist prime minister of Spain. He's blamed the Hydrographic Confederation. He's just blamed various, some of the right-wing media have been blaming Catalan separatists for coming here and causing problems. the right-wing always blames the Catalans if they can in Spain. Who else? So the PSOE, the Socialist Party of Valencia, they sort of taken the opportunity to suggest a technical government. They said, I forget the woman's name, the leader of the Valencian Socialist Party, she suggested that Masson resign and that the socialists would support the conservatives with a technical government for a year or two before the next elections, and that they'll kick Vox out. And the socialists are saying, we need to remove the people who are climate change deniers and who are state deniers. Mm. By state deniers, they mean people who don't believe in the state's ability to do things. It's interesting because there's the slogan that's come out because all the people are going down to help with the floods, the slogan has come out, only the people save the people. And it's because so many volunteers went down and helped out, and the army didn't show up for a couple of days. The police did a little bit, but not much. And there was massive, massive support of everybody trying to help out. In fact, I haven't met a single person in Valencia where I work, in stores, anywhere, who didn't either go down to help out or donated food. So this thing then has become like a bit of a political football. So there was a protest last night that the far right used. It was much smaller. The one against Masson was like 100, over 100,000. This one was like max 300 people, but they were also saying only the people save the people. But of course, they mean white Spanish people, not immigrants and things.
Is there a lot of discourse about climate change in general in Spain? Has this been something that's been talked about, or are there any like seemingly good solutions coming out of the socialist government? And then you talked about the way the right wing responds to it, blaming Catalonians. I've also heard a little bit about people blaming Israel, claiming that Israel created this weather system because the government has in some way sanctioned Israel, cutting off arms sales or something like that. What are the climate change politics in general in Spain?
I think it's probably better than the United States. I looked up recently, and I think they're meeting their climate goals. According to the European, whatever it is, Plan 2030 or whatever. I don't remember the details. I mean, I don't know specifically all the things the socialist government is doing, but I know Vox, the far right party, makes a big deal out of it. And they say that the European climate goals are, you know, attacking small business. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like their posters for the election last year had a big hand throwing out various things like a hammer and sickle, a gay flag, a trans flag, and the, I think it's called Plan 2030, which is the European climate thing. So then, I mean, like everywhere, the socialists, they run against Vox then more than they run against the PP, because they can say, oh, well, you have to get rid of the fascists, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's a global problem, you know, it's not exactly, Spain can't do anything by itself. But yeah, Spain did stop or did deny access to a couple of ships that were going to Israel. But they've also shipped a lot of arms to Israel. Mm-hmm. So
have you heard this rhetoric about Israel's space lasers or whatever creating the weather pattern? Okay.
I have not heard that, no.
Yeah, we get a little bit of that in the United States and people kind of just laugh at it, but I wonder how, because, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a prominent Republican representative, a few years ago blamed, I think it was the wildfires in Hawaii on space lasers that may have been controlled by Jews. I forgot exactly how she framed it. And then she doubled down on it during the recent hurricane, claiming that it was Biden controlling the weather somehow. It just seems like a very convenient, like, right populist reframing of climate change. It's like the, you know, the deep state, the globalists actually control the weather now.
I haven't heard that here. I think Vox is quite pro-Israel.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Makes sense.
And also the PP. I mean, ethno-state. They want to kick out immigrants. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also have links to, say, Trump, for example, and Milei in Argentina, Orban in Hungary. But I mean, usually the conspiracy theories, at least the ones I've heard, are less about Jewish space lasers and more things like pedophiles. They love to blame pedophiles. Also the Basques and the Catalans, the old armed Basque group that disarmed a few years ago, ETA, they always blame them for whatever. Vox is one of the few parties that supported, like, made a statement about the elections, and they supported Trump, and everyone else was just like, we'll let the democratic process run. And in their thing, the leader of Vox said something like, the only people who, this is from the previous election, the only people who support Biden are pedophiles and Basques and Catalans or something like that. So they have different people that they punch, not space lasers. At least I haven't heard it.
Okay, so the Jews are farther down the list. Refreshing for
some. There are no Jews in Spain.
Right, but that doesn't, doesn't necessarily stop the, that actually can make the anti-Semitic rhetoric a little bit worse, but not prominent at the moment, at least. And so the kind of scapegoating of the Catalans, I imagine that has to do with the way the socialists have kind of come to power and stayed to power by aligning with the Catalan separatists, right? Because there's been this resurgent Catalan independence movement over the last 10 years. And I was reading an article by David Broder in Jacobin, I'll post in the show notes, about the last couple years, the complexities of the socialist coalition and how it managed to outpace Vox and the right in general in the last elections. And Broder says something kind of interesting, which is that Spain today is the only EU country with a meaningfully left-wing government. While all other governments may appear progressive on paper, such as Slovenia's, many are either grand coalitions like Denmark's or lean more towards the center than the left like Germany's. Events in Spain then are more decisive than might be imagined. So do you get this impression that there's like a legitimate kind of left hegemony in the state? He says it's basically following the Indignados movement, like that was right before Occupy, and I guess 2011 or so, there was this burst of left populism that's continued to maintain a tenuous electoral coalition.
I would have to disagree.
Okay.
I mean, the left, look, I'm not someone who thinks we should have a left-right alliance, but the left as a phrase, it comes from when the National Assembly in the French Revolution moved from Versailles to Paris, and the Jacobins sat on one side with other nationalist Republicans, and then the monarchists and Catholic people sat on the other. And I'm not entirely sure how useful the phrase "left" as the people that we want to support is. That said, it is a left government. The Socialist Party, the PSOE, is the same Socialist Party it's been for a long time. They're pretty standard European Socialist Party. They, in the last election, because there was a European election and the far right did quite well, so Sanchez, who is our very handsome prime minister here, is quite good at playing the political games, and he called a snap election and then ran basically against the far right. And so he called for an anti-fascist coalition and wanted everyone to vote for him. The Conservative Party actually got more votes than the Socialists, but because they were planning to be in a coalition with Vox, nobody else would go into the coalition with them because Vox, basically it has to do with how the Spanish state is created. The Spanish state is quite decentralized, like I was saying, with autonomous communities. And in the autonomous community, for example, in the Catalan region or the Basque region or in Valencia, public schools teach other languages besides Spanish. So they teach Basque or Valencian or Catalan. And so the left in all of those areas are usually quite nationalist, in Galicia too. So those, and even some of the sort of center parties. So there's a party I would call liberal, kind of center-right party, Junts in Catalonia, which is aligned with the Socialist Party because they can't possibly align with a government that has Vox in it, because Vox wants to re-centralize the state, get rid of all the separatist elements. And so, yeah, it is a left coalition in government. How left they actually are, I'm not super convinced. Uh-huh. They did raise the minimum wage slightly a couple of years ago. They haven't been able to do anything about housing. I mean, they're not actively, they don't have a racist discourse or anything like that, but all the things that the state does continue. Lots and lots of people die every day trying to get into Spain or deported under a socialist government. Rents just keep going up and they don't seem to be able to do anything about it. So I'm not that convinced. Also, the party that came out of the Indignados thing, I would say the party that recuperated the Indignados movement, Podemos, they have been sort of supplanted by a slightly less radical party called Sumar. And the guy who was the leader of Podemos now runs a bar for Reds, he calls it, in the neighborhood I used to live in Madrid. And they have cocktails like the Che Guevara cocktail. Yeah.
Excellent.
The anarchists in the neighborhood were tagging it because he had a Daruti cocktail and was like, get our anarchist heroes out of your mouth, you goddamn socialist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always, I think, good to tell these stories to U.S. listeners, because there's, I think it's probably at a low point now, but there's always been this hope that the Democrats can regenerate as a true left party or true social democratic party in some way. And as much as I like to see that happen, it's just, if we look to social democracy in Europe, or even like the kind of more social movement fueled left parties like Podemos, once in power, they there are much larger problems than that kind of populist rhetoric can really solve. And so, bring that back to these disasters, whether they be hurricanes or flooding. You do see these incredible popular mobilizations of mutual aid, of recovery, just from neighbors helping dig each other out, do what they can within their own area. We've seen a ton of that in the U.S. and in Appalachia. More left people see that and think the slogan you mentioned, like the people help the people, or in New York, at least, there's been the slogan, "We keep us safe." It's kind of this anti-police or police abolitionist slogan. And so in a way, these images of people throwing mud at the king and like coming to the, filling the squares in Valencia, demanding Mazón resign, is a little bit of a horizon for us. Like, can we turn these disasters into like a rejection of governmentality as it exists? But on the other hand, like, we do need, like you said, like the firefighters and like the military coming to rescue people. We don't have helicopters. We don't have the boats to do this. We don't have the coordination, the capacity. So I think there does have to be some sort of governmentality to resolving these crises too, and certainly to building resilient infrastructure. So it's sort of a contradiction in our thinking. Like, on one hand, we reject the government. On the other hand, we need coordination, that kind of capacity. What do you think about that?
That's a good question. I'm someone who's usually quite I'm not particularly hopeful often. I'm quite skeptical and a bit, this is going to end badly all the time, especially about climate change. So surprisingly, I've got all these messages recently because people know I'm living in Valencia and they say, oh my God, are you all right? And actually I've come out of this whole disaster with more hope and a bit more optimistic than I normally am. And mainly just because, well, A, so many people immediately, their first instinct was to help out, like you said. And also, so like it's exactly the opposite of what we always see in like zombie movies, mm-hmm. or The Last of Us, that kind of thing, where everyone's suddenly like, I'm just going to protect my daughter, right, and kill everybody else. So immediately everyone's like, oh, what do people need? Talking to their neighbors, going to the stores to get shovels and helping. And so that was one thing. The other thing is that I didn't see too much blaming of immigrants or that sort of thing. The far right parties are trying to do that. But if you look at, like when I went down 2 days to help out. And for example, there's a bridge that crosses over the river there. And as I was crossing that bridge, I heard 6 different languages being spoken: Spanish, Valencian, English, Arabic, Italian. I don't remember them all, but a bunch of different languages being spoken. And it was very like, you know, there is a possibility of the diverse working class making a response to climate change, which, as opposed to just devolving in on ourselves and I don't know, being racist or just protecting our own kind of thing.
Like a Hobbesian war of all against all imaginary of these disasters where, yeah, you better just get your gun and shoot anyone who comes to try to take your stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
On the other hand, so the first couple of days, the state didn't do much from what I could see. And everything that individuals could do seemed like individuals were doing. The police were not there the first day when I went down. The second day, there was a line of police, and all they were doing was kind of making sure people walked in the right side of the bridge, and it was just making it all a bit slower. Mm. The army has been mobilized. It's the largest, I think it's the largest peacetime mobilization of the Spanish army ever, I think. And the army are down there. The first couple of days, they mobilized like the equivalent of the National Guard. And so it's a lot of, I went to a meeting recently of self-organized community groups, and they were talking about how to respond to this. So it was like some feminist groups, some anarchist groups, some immigrant groups, and they were talking about what to do. And basically it's the same thing everyone's doing, which is making contacts, bringing food, water, shovels, donating bikes, furniture, whatever people need. And they were down there at the meeting. They were saying people were down there, and the army was not actually helping out that much. Like they, because the army, the nice thing about having all the volunteers, the bad side is it's a bit disorganized. The nice side is you go down there and you can just immediately help. Whereas the army were kind of standing around blocking things. They were mostly 18-year-old kids who had been called up for the emergency, waiting for orders, just kind of getting in the way. Now, from people who are down there, I've heard that they're being more helpful because what a lot of the sort of individual cleaning stuff that needs to be done is not really doesn't need to be done anymore. And what needs to be done now is, you know, cranes and stuff, moving all the piled cars out of the way and that sort of thing. And the government has apparently set up areas where they'll give you new ID cards and that sort of thing. Mm. Now, obviously you need cranes and you need plows and bulldozers to move those things out of the way. Although I've also heard stories of just farmers from around here. There was a guy interviewed on the radio the other day I was listening to who just drove his tractor down and pushed cars out of the way for a few days in a row. So even in those kinds of things, I'm not sure how helpful the government is being. But yeah, absolutely, the government has control of the infrastructure.
All right, so I've got a last question generally about Spain and its relationship to the EU. This comes from my co-host, Sean, who had his tonsils out this week, so he couldn't join us. I was hoping either I could make an AI, Sean, to ask his questions, but that seemed a little bit more complicated than I was ready to do, although someone from the Discord did make an AI Sean voice, but I would have had to download a lot of software to use it, or that he would come on and just sound like RFK Jr. and ask these questions, but I don't think he's quite up to it yet. But he asks, what is the organized left like in Spain? You covered this a little bit regarding Podemos and the unions. And then what's the relationship with the EU? How does the slow decline of Germany look from one of the pigs? And the pigs refers to Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. This, I guess, sort of the BRICS countries of the EU, the more subaltern bloc of the EU.
Well, Spain has a... To start with the parties, Spain has a number of left parties. There's Podemos, which is was the one that came out of the movement of the squares. Mm-hmm. There's a new, slightly less left one that is now in coalition, and they're bigger. They took a lot of Podemos's votes, which is Sumar, and I think they're much less substantive. They don't come out of the social movement in the same way. And they're more about making symbolic things, although they are, their discourse, what they talk about is more left than the Socialist Party. Then in each region, the parties of the left tend to be kind of nationalist left, or either independentistas or like culturally nationalist, like they make a point of speaking either Valencian or Catalan or Gallego or Basque. I think the furthest left of the major parties is a party called Bildu, which is in the Basque region, and they're kind of Republican socialists. They're also part of the government. The right and the PP, the Conservative Party, are always blaming them because I think they're kind of in the same milieu as the old armed Basque people. So, you know, a bit like a Sinn Féin IRA kind of thing. Like, so that's the parties. They exist. They're fourth, fifth, sixth biggest parties like that. The big ones are the Conservative Party, the Socialists, and Vox. And then the left parties are smaller than them. Then there's the unions. So the unionization works very differently in Spain than it does in the United States. In the United States, you have either closed shop kind of states or right to work states, and you need to unionize a place. You get a vote, and then your shop is union. In Spain, you can join a union if you want to, but the people who join the unions tend to be the union activists. And it's not like masses of people have to join unions to be covered by the union deals. So the unions negotiate by sector. And so, for example, I'm an English teacher, and there's a contract negotiated by various unions with the employers association and the government. It's a category, and it applies to my job. And anyone who works in that job has those rights and those conditions. And it's the same for other things. Some of the unions are more radical than others. It's very legalistic. It's all very incorporated into a legal framework. I was involved in a group when I lived in Madrid that it was a bit like the Seattle Solidarity Network, where we were trying to help out individuals who had problems with an individual boss, and through direct action or that sort of thing. And one of the big problems in Spain is that everything is so legalistic. So if you have a problem with your boss, you have much better rights than you do in the United States, like vacations, maternity, all those sorts of things. But you all need to go through a legal process to get them, and you basically need to hire a lawyer or a professional to do it for you. So you have better rights than in the United States, but it also has the effect of dissipating organizing, and especially dissipating organizing if it's a small thing. That said, there was a big metal workers strike a couple of years ago in Cádiz, and the socialist government sent in the tanks and put it down. I mean, there is some militant unionism that goes on. What was the other question? Oh, the Europe.
The pigs.
The pigs, yes. So yeah, Spain is a poorer country in Europe. Tourism is a big thing here. I think they have some car manufacturing, and a lot of Europe's vegetables come from Spain. Honestly, I think the only people really making money in Spain are landlords, though, just like everywhere. So Spain depends a lot on tourists coming in, and they spread money around. The thing is, I mean, the weird thing about Spain is that Spain, if Spain was not part of the European Union, Spain could lower its currency value and then undercut other people for exports. But because it's part of the European Union with Germany, who well, until recently, it was a massive exporter. It allows Germany to keep their currency lower and Spain to keep theirs higher. So Germany's exports are better and Spain has to sell their exports at a higher level. So it's like, actually, there are certain ways in which being in the European Union is not good for the Spanish economy. On the other hand, it's a big area of free movement and free trade. So those things are good for Spain. I mean, the whole European Union is in trouble, kind of like a lot of the world. Wages are not going up. Rents are going up like crazy. I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of like Brexit kind of stuff here. When I was in France a couple of years ago, I heard people talking about Frexit, and right. It's still quite a marginal thing there. But I haven't heard that much here. I think even the Vox and the far right parties, they're more interested in trying to take over the European Union. Mm-hmm. That's my impression anyway. And there's sort of European far right blocks that they coordinate. And
yeah, so transitioning a bit to the U.S., I found this article about Spain's Congress approves bill to cancel golden visa program in January 2025. This is from Schengen.news. So it seems like there was a program where you could buy a Spanish citizenship basically by buying 500,000 euros worth of property in Spain. That would give you a Spanish visa or passport.
I think it gave you residency.
Okay,
I
don't know, so not citizenship, visa, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, once you're a resident, it's just a matter of time and you can get a passport. Yeah, the Socialist Party, I'm not sure if it actually passed, I don't remember. But yeah, there was all this talk because after the pandemic, rents just went up like crazy. My rent in Madrid, when I lived, because I lived in Madrid for 5 years, when I moved there, I was paying one thing. And then when I left, it would have been about double if I hadn't decided to move to Valencia. So there was all these protests and all this, everyone's talking about the rental problem in Spain. And that was the socialist government's response to it, which was weak to say the least. Uh-huh. But yeah, it is a bit crazy that you can just buy residency. It's cheaper in Portugal. You can do it in Portugal too. A lot of countries are like that though. You can get residency if you put in this much money into buying a property, or I think Canada has one too. If you put in so much money and you start a business that employs two Canadian citizens. I don't remember the details, but that's pretty typical everywhere.
Yeah, so I thought that'd be a good way to transition, because for two reasons. One is that I have noticed a lot of conversations with friends of mine about Trump being elected for his second term. There is this attitude of like, well, time to get out of the United States, time to move to Berlin or whatever, which, you know, I understand that desire to like just get out of a bad situation. But you move to Berlin, AFD is just going to be elected there soon. So I feel like this is not a unique problem to the United States. And I don't know where you would go to really escape this issue of the right making gains based on, you know, these various crises of global instability. And then second, just talking about your book, The Housing Monster, which is coming out with a second edition from PM Press with an introduction from our own Sean KB, as well as Lazaro Editions, our friends in Argentina, who we've had on the show before as well. But yeah, I mean, I've definitely heard a lot about these questions of kind of international real estate speculation and consolidation. It's become a bit of a populist issue in the United States. Typically, the right tends to talk about it more than anyone else, about groups like BlackRock buying up tons of property. But I definitely hear a lot about it from Spain, especially in Barcelona, where so much of the city has been converted to Airbnbs, and the left-wing government tries to roll that back in various ways. So yeah, maybe we can talk a bit about the housing monster, the kind of concept of the book, and how maybe it relates to this moment.
All right. Yeah, first of all, I wouldn't say moving to Spain to escape Trump is necessarily going to help. I mean, there's far right here, there's far right there. We do have free public health care here, though, which is nice. For the moment, they're trying to privatize it, but we'll see. But yeah, The Housing Monster. So this is the manifesto book, whatever, that I wrote a few years ago when I was working in construction. I'm an English teacher now, but back then I was an electrician's apprentice. I was trying to look at, basically I have kind of my idea when I write books in general is you can take any starting point, and then everything's going to be related to it. So in this case, I was working in construction, so I was trying to look closely at what a construction site how it works, why it works the way it works, and then you tie in more and more things. And I did something similar when I worked in restaurants, which was my pamphlet, Abolish Restaurants. And I'm currently working on a new one as well, which will be about education, but it's years down the road. So in that case, I had a part where I was talking about the sort of the exploitation and the problems of construction workers. And then the second half of the pamphlet is about all the problems with neighborhoods and how housing as a commodity causes these problems. In terms of gentrification, yeah, there's all sorts of problems. I mean, they're the kinds of things you've all heard before. Rents are going up. Airbnbs are replacing people. I was in New Orleans last year, and it's the same problem that's happening in the areas of Valencia or in Barcelona, where it's a landlord can make more money renting out to tourists than they can to local people. And then the house, of course, stays empty. For example, the place I used to live in, Madrid, was right across from an Airbnb. And so it was just completely empty all day. And then on the weekends, it was full with tourists who would come in from the weekends. And it's just because you're managing it based on as a commodity. So you make as much money as you can. And that's how it works. I don't know. how do you decommodify housing? Is that the question?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is sort of the question because, yeah, I feel like the way the left tends to look at these housing questions, which you sort of flesh out the complexities of it in the book very well. But yeah, there's this idea of rent control, for example, in the United States I feel like that's the main left horizon. Like we've got a socialist running for mayor in New York who is a big part of his platform is going to be a rent freeze, which the Democrats often flirt with and then roll back because more or less would be illegal. There's probably legal ways to do it, but it's easier said than done with the laws the way they are and with real estate being the main political power in the state. And then there's eviction defense, which is like mobilize people to stop evictions from happening, which maybe I think in probably other places it would work, but in the United States, it can only really work short term, like keep somebody in a house for a few more months than they would have been otherwise. Because if you don't own the house, you know, you can't stay there forever. But yeah, what are some other horizons for dealing with these housing questions other than just trying to control rent or control eviction?
Well, I mean, I it's a good idea to try these sorts of things. I think people sometimes are confused about how reforms happen on the left. So I think there's this widespread idea that if we organize well and we make demands, then the demands get met because we organized well. And it's just not how the state interacts with social movements. The way that the state responds to social movements is the social movement causes a problem for the state. And then the government tries to do something about it to solve that problem. It might be a problem as in they're losing votes. It might be a problem as in they're blocking roads. It might be a problem, I don't know, they're shooting politicians, you know, depending on how serious of a historical crisis you're talking about. And then they respond in various ways. Sometimes they respond by jailing people or killing them or repressing people. Sometimes they respond by completely ignoring. And other times they respond by making concessions and co-opting the movement. And you have to look at social movements and their interaction with the state based on these sort of balance of powers and why the state does what the state does. So it would be better to have rent control than not. It would be better to have more tenant protections than not. But I don't think you get to those situations by running socialist politicians. You get to those situations because you have a movement that can't be repressed. And so they're giving you, they're trying to co-opt you instead. And obviously it's better to be co-opted than to be repressed. But in both cases, what they're trying to do is trying to destroy the movement. Mm-hmm. Tenant organizing, squatting is a big thing in Spain. It's a lot more difficult in the US because they just evict you quite quickly. But causing disruptions, basically, is what I would say is the important thing.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that there's one positive development in New York over the last year, actually, is a small but impressive return of a squatters movement. There's, I think, two squats in Williamsburg right now. I mean, people have squatted in various ways in the city forever, but there was a major squatting movement in the U.S. and especially in New York in the 70s and 80s, But that was when real estate was worth so little, landlords were burning down their buildings. So actually having squatters in certain situations was good for the city because you kept, especially if they were fixing these buildings on their own labor and preventing landlords from starting fires, it was actually a benefit. But now that real estate, especially in New York, but everywhere, is worth so much, it's just the value of letting people live in a building is next to nothing if they're not paying, if the mortgage isn't getting paid, if like the owners aren't getting something from that. So the squatting movement as it exists now in the US, and I imagine in Spain too, has to be way more confrontational, way more protective of that property because it's a harder thing to co-opt, right?
Yeah, the people I know who live in squats in Spain usually try to find somebody who's an absentee landlord or a building that's owned by the government, so they know it'll take a long time. Everything in Spain is very bureaucratic, so it usually takes a long time to kick people out, and there are certain protections. One of the reforms that the socialist government sometimes does is like you can't evict people at this time of year, or you can't evict, you know, the temporary little moratoriums on eviction. If the person's pregnant or the person's in a wheelchair, you can't evict them. So there's certain little protections. There's more squatting here than there is in the United States. There's a lot of real estate speculation also. If you go to the neighborhood by the beach here in Valencia, it's called Cabañal, and it's gentrifying, but it's also an old working class fisherman neighborhood. And there's just tons of abandoned properties all bricked up, and that the squatters I know live in areas around there. Squatting in Spain has also become, like I said, it's bigger than in the United States, but it's not that big. There aren't that many people squatting, and it's become a big political football here, especially with Vox. And if you ask random people about squatting, they'll be like, oh, squatting, because the media is always talking about it, and like you're getting ads. If you go open YouTube here, you get ads for like anti-squatter door protection devices and things. There's a kind of vigilante group called Desocupa, which is like anti-unsquat or anti-squat. And they actually did a photo op down in the southern neighborhoods in Valencia too. And they're like, you know, go and try to evict people in a vigilante way.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I mean, they haven't done very much because they're more like, what's the word? They're more like an online thing, I think, or they're more like trying to like build up their like macho image. But yeah, they have evicted people and stabbed people. And
wow.
Things, yeah.
What, just because the squatters are scapegoated for making the neighborhoods worse, or is it like a landlord-funded initiative?
I think it's a landlord-funded or at least far-right-funded thing. And you can blame it, you throw it in with the Catalans and the Basques and the pedophiles and the communists. It's the squatters also causing problems. They'll steal your house. I mean, the thing that you hear on the news all the time here is, don't be careful if you leave your house, squatters will come in and take it. It's just like, that just doesn't happen, you know?
Yeah, there was some rhetoric about that in our election as well. That it was interesting because it was particularly focused around a town in Colorado where there was a building where a lot of, I think mostly Venezuelan migrants lived, or probably Venezuelan asylum seekers. And they were living there legally, but it was like a slum. And I think so they went on rent strike. And then there was this massive, right-wing media expose of it, claiming that like a Venezuelan gang had taken over this building and was going to take over this town. And there are some like TikTok type videos circulating amongst the migrant community of people saying, you know, if you need a place to live, here's how you squat. And those sort of went viral, playing into this Trumpist rhetoric that the Venezuelan or not necessarily even Venezuelan, just migrants are coming and taking over your homes. And there was an interesting kind of convergence of it in my world where you saw people saying, obviously this rhetoric is racist, but the truth of it is that the squatters are all these anarcho-punks who like don't care about anything except for getting free rent, and it's bad for small homeowners. And so there's squatting plays on this middle-class anxiety of someone on one hand getting something for nothing, and then on the other hand, privileged people or dangerous gangsters trying to take away what little you have as a working class person.
Yeah, I think in Spain, there's definitely, you have your anarcho-punks, but you know, anarcho-punks are people too. The anarcho-punks I know who squat, they work regular jobs in supermarkets or teachers or, you know, drivers or whatever. But then also I think here you have a lot of sort of very marginal people who squat also. And, you know, there's slum cities outside of some major cities in Spain too. I mean,
yeah. And generally, like as we saw in with natural disasters, but it's also true of migrants who arrive to a place with no resources, often very limited legal ability to even rent, let alone get a job. You know, people are going to survive the way that they can survive. And you're an anarcho-punk and, you know, maybe you could clean up and get a job and pay rent. That's not necessarily true for everybody. And I would like the concept of squatting to return to a left discourse in the country as a protected and valorized thing, but we're not quite there yet. I think people still have this perception of it being, there's a very anti-punk attitude on the left in the United States.
Well, I don't like punk music, but I like punks. But I mean, I think the thing about the United States you have to remember is that it has a lot of homeowners still. Spain is vast majority renters. And Spain, the United States is weird in that the government heavily subsidizes homeownership, which is a specific political policy that they do to try to promote people having a stake, you know.
Right.
Who is it? Was it Margaret Thatcher? Someone said no one who owns their own house can ever be a communist, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a specific thing. You have property. There's something, absolutely. I mean, you're forced to speculate. You're forced to worry about house prices. And the whole U.S. housing system is very much designed around that. The government, instead of funding rental housing or something like that, they are funding loans to homeowners. Mm-hmm. Because in most other countries, working class people can't get a home loan for 30 years with cheap interest. It's harder now in the U.S. than it was before, but all those the government-backed loans allows people to get that.
Trying to turn this back to Trump a little bit, you know, I think there's some significance, although I can't really put my finger on it, to this guy being sort of the center of this right populist international, and also him being a real estate mogul. And I think this is something that's still playing out, and we're going to see it play out with his kind of family real estate empire. Like his son Jared Kushner is trying to build hotels in the Balkans. I think he's got a plan to like rebuild Gaza City as like a Trump city, more or less. Do you think there's something about Trump being this like rapacious real estate guy being kind of the center of this right wing upsurge? Is there like a real estate aspect to this?
I mean, like I said before, it seems like the only people who are making money these days are landlords. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely something there. I mean, it's this weird thing that the right libertarians or the economists are always talking about, we need to cut off people who are getting something for nothing, but landlords are getting something for nothing. They're getting something just for having the property. So it's this sort of central contradiction in a lot of the right or the economic discourse that we have. I don't know. Symbolically, you see him and he's a real estate mogul and a racist and a sexual assaulter. And yeah, he's just symbolic of all the horrible things these days.
Yeah, but I think but the real estate part, I think, kind of works for him because there's this idea that he's built these huge buildings. And if you just let him build all these buildings, then, you know, there's kind of like a YIMBYism to it, like the price, you know, the prices will go down. And this is more or less was his campaign rhetoric, is like, we're going to build these new cities on federally owned lands, and then there will be more housing and prices will go down. And it's all pie in the sky stuff. But I think there's a kind of populist appeal to the idea of like building new things, building new infrastructure, making more room for people to live. And you know, obviously, my perspective is there's plenty of room for people to live. There's more empty housing than there are homeless people. There just needs to
be. Isn't it like 27 or 24 houses for every homeless person, 24 empty houses for every homeless person in the United States right now?
Yeah, it's whatever the number is. It's like it's such a clear example of how, You don't even have to be like redistributive to think about how to solve these problems. You just have to match up the resources with the people that need it. But that has to, the only way to do that is like a, frankly, a revolutionary restructuring of property relations. And that's not something, you know, anyone can really reasonably propose. Like the Democrats' response to Trump was actually housing deregulation, like cutting red tape. And that would theoretically make housing prices go down, which I don't think anybody bought.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly answering your question, but in response to that, that makes me think of people I know who voted for Trump. So I think, again, it's to go back to the thing about what does the state do and then what do politicians run on? And the state does the things it does for reasons that are quite different from what politicians say they're going to do and the kinds of campaigns they decide to run on. So, for example, I had an uncle who lived in Florida, and he voted for Trump the first time because he said Trump was going to help immigrants out, because he thought that immigrants were getting a raw deal and he needed somebody in there who was going to help out immigrants. And then the second time, he didn't vote for Trump. He voted for Biden because he said Trump was too bad on the environment. And this time, I haven't been doing this, but I've been talking to some people who've been listening to the right-wing talk show call-in shows after the election. And a lot of people who are on these call-in shows, from the very unscientific hearsay I've heard, are talking about the wars. And they're saying, you know, Trump said he's going to end the war. These wars are terrible. We got to stop this. And so it's really easy for people, you know, who are to the left of the Democratic Party to say, oh, these Trump people are crazy. They're just projecting onto Trump these things he's never going to do. Trump's just as warlike as Biden. Trump's, you know, not going to help immigrants. That's just crazy, even though he probably said, oh, I'm here for legal immigrants. On the other hand, the exact same thing happens with the Democrats. People say, oh, the Democrats are there for the working man. In what way are the Democrats helping out working people? Or the Democrats are gonna help out abortion rights. The Democrats run on abortion rights because they don't protect them, so that they can be like, oh, we gotta do something about this. So I think there's just as much projection onto left parties as there is onto right parties. It's just that people are like, no, but the Democrats. And really, they're just going to keep doing the same things that the state is doing, and it's going to continue in the same direction.
Yeah, so let me ask you, I know you've been outside the United States for a long time, but it seems like you follow what's going on here to some extent.
Of course.
One thing I've been thinking about since Trump's been elected, you know, when he was elected in 2016, there was this kind of mass devastation, like this, you know, deep depression that actually mobilized people towards various groups that were going to try to fight the Trump administration in certain ways, be it anti-fascism or, you know, ICE watches, eviction defense, the Women's March, and like sort of more feminist networks to protect abortion rights or to help people get abortions. And this all became the resistance, like the capital R resistance, and it kind of got co-opted by the Democratic Party for the most part. But at the beginning, there was something we call the Trump bump, this like autonomous groundswell of action that, you know, led to these riots on Trump's inauguration day and these street fights with fascists for about a year after that. And I'm not really feeling that this time. I think we're going to see it, because obviously if he's, you know, sending, you know, militarized ICE agents into immigrant communities, people are going to fight back in certain ways. And then there's always going to be these networks of people helping one another get abortions or helping one another survive in whatever way. So that's going to happen. And there has been a bit, you know, at like left meetings, like there was like a ILC meeting, which is a group Sean and I are involved with, that had over 100 people last week. So there is a bit of a Trump bump. There are people like trying to think about how to politically mobilize, but there's also this widespread disillusionment with how that was done in 2016, understanding it as just like ending up at the dead end of like trying to get a Democrat reelected, hopefully Bernie Sanders, but whoever, just like trying to get Trump out. So I guess, yeah, what do you think like we could do in the United States? Well, how could we do the resistance in a way that doesn't end up at that Democratic dead end?
I mean, I wasn't in the United States when Trump was elected last time, but I heard, yeah, from outside that there was the protests against the Muslim ban and those sorts of things. I don't know, man. I think it's just about having some basic principles. Like, I was never someone who was very excited about Bernie Sanders, because I've been to Burlington, Vermont, and I've heard the people who are involved in in sort of municipalist, you know, Murray Bookchin and those people were around there, and they had a critique of Bernie Sanders and how he was part of the Democratic Party from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You can go back and read that from like the 80s. And if the thing, it keeps going back to people wanting to be co-opted as opposed to wanting to be repressed. It's like, what we really want is someone who tries to destroy our movement through giving us reforms, as opposed to try to destroy our movement through repressing us. Mm-hmm. And if that's the limit of your horizon, your movement is going to be destroyed. So you want people who are not trying to destroy your movement. Therefore, you want people who are not trying to integrate into the state, because that's what the state does. So I think, personally, if there's any Democratic Party politicians who come down to any of these movements, assuming we do get some sort of movements that happen when he's elected, when he starts doing heinous things, and he is going to do heinous things, if an AOC comes down or if Bernie comes down, they should be booed and kicked out, because they're complicit in everything the government's been doing the last couple of years. And it's not like Biden has been any different in terms of all the horrible things the government's doing. In fact, possibly worse than Trump with the Palestinian genocide. Outside of that, I don't really have specific ideas. Be disruptive.
And that's generally how I'm thinking too, is that we should do resistance things, although we have to conceive of it not as resistance, but as building autonomous power. And if you do like secretly yearn for co-optation, like that'll come anyway, if your power is strong enough. And then in terms of relaying to the Democrats, I've got kind of like a micro perspective on this, being a part of Woodbine, which is a social center in Ridgewood, Queens, that has various mutual aid initiatives, including a food pantry. And our way of dealing with co-optation and the state is generally, if the de Blasio or now Adams administration wants to give us some pallets of food to distribute, we'll take it. Or if a politician wants to hits us up and offers us something, we'll take it, but we're not going to give anything back. We're not going to like shun that help because, you know, we need to get our garbage picked up, for example. And sometimes it's good to like be able to call somebody who works in the bureaucracy and say, they're not picking up the garbage because we have too much, because we're running a food pantry. Like, can you send someone over? And that stuff like that works. So it's, you know, a fine line of trying to be autonomous, and then just, you can't just pretend the state doesn't exist, because the state is what manages public space now and things like garbage, electricity, and everything. But yeah, we don't make demands on politicians. We don't put out press statements saying, give us our funding back or increase funding. We say, you know, when Adams came in, he cut those pallets of food that we were getting. And we said, well, we're going to continue to operate without him. But like, shame on the Adams administration for cutting this funding. Like, people need it. And then shortly afterwards, it was restored to some extent. That's kind of like the model we've used for the last 4 years or so. And I think that can continue to work. So I wouldn't necessarily boo AOC, but I would definitely, if she's...
I would definitely boo AOC.
if she's coming to help, like, you know, kind of like when the King of Spain came down. Here have a shovel. Here's yeah. Where you have to dig. If you're trying to do anything else, we're going to throw mud at you.
Fair enough. I mean, at this point, I think AOC is so tied into the genocide in Gaza that I think you'd be right to boo her just for showing up. But yeah, fair enough. I mean,
she is,
if they're coming down just to dig dirt,
is one of the very few politicians who are calling it a genocide and are vocally against it. That doesn't excuse her, you know, parroting the Harris line that they're working tirelessly for a ceasefire. That's obviously was never true. And so, yeah, shame on her for saying that. But in terms of if there's any allies within the state, she's closest to us than anyone else. And I think the dream, even if from an autonomous perspective, is that if more of those people exist, if there's more people in the squad or just in the city government, they will help us in some way without necessarily co-opting us. But then, yeah, you get the danger of people thinking that is the solution and we should become Democrats and elect more of them. And that's the only thing we can really do.
I think you have to talk about what the state is. And the state is a number of overlapping things. It has a hard core, which is organized military, organized violence, the police and the military and industrial military complex. Then it also has various different functions where it negotiates between competing interests, like, say, landlords and bosses. And if at certain times, like industrialists have supported controlling rent because rent puts upward pressure on wages. And so, you know, the state has to regulate between those things. Another thing the state is it's kind of like a magic spell that gets cast on activity that people are doing. So what does it mean to be part of the state or to have people in the state? And there's this thing where, like, for example, I'm very happy that I live in a place with public healthcare. And in order to get into, to become a public nurse, here you have to pass a very complicated state civil service exam. And if you live in Valencia, you have to speak Valenciano very well. And it's like a whole thing. And then it gets funding from the state. Now, what makes that part of the state versus other things? Or a political party, when they're running for election, are they part of the state? Or are they part of the state when they're outside the state? Like, where does that happen? But I think you have to look at what the state does. And what the state does is it creates strategies for how to manage capitalist development. And I would be very suspicious of trying to link any social movements to putting forward proposals on how to manage capitalist development. So, for example, I'm not against making demands. Demands, especially if they're concrete things like give us a house or pay us more, things like that. I'm fully in favor of making demands. I just don't think that the demands you make are related to the concessions you get in the kind of easy way that leftist mythology gives it. It's like we demand this, we organize, we get this demand. No, the state decides how best to destroy your movement. I mean, we had the abolish police protests, the Black Lives Matter, and everyone was saying, you know, abolish the police. Or then maybe it got diluted a bit to defund the police. And then what did we get? How did the state decide to do it? They beat people up, or they gave us some new black politicians. So the state is going to respond to your demands how the state wants to, not how we decide to. So I would make a big distinction between being inside the state and being someone who's trying to formulate a way to manage capitalist development. So I would not support democratic politicians, because I think those are people who are trying to get in the central committee of the state and try to manage capitalist development. Whereas a firefighter, it's their job, they work for the state. On a certain level, they're part of the state. Same thing with a nurse in a public hospital. They are sort of part of the state, but that's the state on a certain level is just kind of this floaty thing happening over activity and doesn't have clear boundaries.
Yeah, and you would say the same thing about like Podemos or like the left parties in Spain.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think what we agree on is just that this principle of autonomy and trying to expand the power of our groups in themselves without assuming the state will do anything to help us. And, you know, as the group becomes more powerful, we'll have the luxury of having these questions of like how we deal with the politicians when they come knocking on our door. And hopefully we'll make the right answer. And yeah, hopefully those networks are forming now. Let me just ask you one more question about your work. Probably most of our listeners have seen your work and are familiar with its style of this kind of isotopic, faceless workers, very iconic. Do you have like a sort of theory behind the style, or like what are its origins?
I think I saw it as a style in advertising first, actually. I copied it from advertisements. What'd you say?
Do you remember what advertising?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Sorry. But I feel like it was something I saw on a few advertisements back in the like early 2000s. Hmm. But usually with color, and I usually do black and white. I mean, I write anonymously, and I do that partially because I don't want some fascist to dox me, but also partially because I'm not trying to make a name for myself and get an academic job or, you know, get into a political party. So there is an element of principle that these writings should stand on their own and not you shouldn't be looking at me and trying to judge me. And then I think the writings should stand on their own, but relate them to your own personal experience. And if that's far stronger if it resonates with your personal experience than if I have a lot of academic citations or degrees or something like that. So the style, partially it's just how I like to draw things in Photoshop, but partially I did like the sort of anonymousness of the, this could be any one thing. Although then often if you look at the book, there's a lot of people who are very specific people. Like I have a picture of Bill Clinton in one of them. I have a picture of Gilles Dauvet in one of them. Like they're very specific people mm-hmm. in there also.
So was it inspired at all by Gerhard Arndt, who was this German council communist?
Oh, I love Gerhard Arndt, yeah.
But that wasn't the direct Absolutely. Inspiration?
Partially. I do love Gerhard Arndt. It's great stuff. I see you put that in the background
yeah.
here. No, that's great. Gerhard Arndt is very old-fashioned a lot. Like all the workers have a cloth cap and all the capitalists have a top hat.
Uh-huh.
Definitely that was a source of inspiration too.
I always think it's, we've been talking about these cycles of recuperation, and I think he's an interesting example because his work is so radical and so iconic, but like obviously the influence of it has been on, street signs, like the men and women placard on bathrooms, so he's become a major, influence in like the semiotic nature of modernity. But without like the sort of radical conception of the art is kind of just known to us. Like if I see like a group like the Council Communists, Communist Caucus of the DSA uses Gerhard Arndt's imagery, I immediately know like, oh, these people are probably close to me because they like Gerhard Arndt. Like that that aesthetic is very of our milieu. But at the same time, mm-hmm. it's the real influence of it has been like the creation of this symbolic management of society.
Yeah, I mean, you never know how things are going to be taken.
I mean, hopefully, your work will go on that way too.
Well, I've seen a lot of. I used to have a thing on the site that said the misuse of this site, and I now just say please ask if you want to use the artwork. And usually, I'm not particularly sectarian. I'm just like. Use it as long as it's not something heinous. Mm-hmm. But I did have some terrible uses. I had a group that rewrote one of my things and said they had taken out the influence of Bakunin.
Oh,
and it
great.
Was like half as long. And that was a Russian group a while ago. And so there's been some bad uses as well. But I mean, it's on the internet. Everything's free on the internet.
Yeah, there could be like an anarchist cut of your book where they take out the Trotsky and the Marx as well.
There's no Trotsky.
there's a Trotsky quote in The Housing Monster.
Oh, there is, but it's just a quote to show you how the Bolsheviks were taking on the role of the capitalists to develop the. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a Milton Friedman quote too. But I mean,
So everyone, if you haven't already, go to prol.info and download that stuff. Like I said, if I was working with someone who wanted to know more about my politics, I would not give them a copy of Das Kapital or something. I would give them Work, Community, Politics, War. This is such a funner and easier read, so highly recommended to distribute this stuff. Anything else you want to plug about your work or just things that you like these days?
Just two things. One is that as you said before, the second edition of The Housing Monsters is coming out in February, I believe, from PM Press. Check out PM Press, they're great. They have lots of radical books. There's a couple of new prefaces, and I think they fixed some spelling mistakes, but there's a preface by Sean about relating The Housing Monster to it because he's a construction worker, relating to his life as a construction worker. There is a preface by some Argentinian comrades called Las Ediciones. They're the ones who did the Spanish translation, and they related a bit to the Argentinian context. And then there's another friend of mine, Ben Criticos, who did the audiobook version, and he's in Scotland, does a very good podcast about the political history of blues, if you're interested. It's called Red, White, Blues.
Oh, that's cool.
And also, if you want to read anything by this group, Las Ediciones, they put out a lot of stuff in Spanish, and they have a very good, or they're related to an interesting theoretical magazine called Cuadernos de Negación, if you read Spanish. Mm-hmm. It's like negation notebooks. It's a communist theory about everything.
Great stuff coming out from Argentina, as always. Thanks for joining us. And so the second edition of the book comes out in February, right? So
I think that's
so right. Well, maybe we can have you on again around then. Talk about
that'd be great.
Talk about the MAGA city that Trump is going to build on federal land.
Amazing.
Thanks so much for joining us. No Bible, but we got a couple of candles. No drama, but we got a lot of ammo. I remember having hammers in my jam smoke. Gang. Nigga, I'm from Grove Street, nigga, 5751, nigga. I'm from Upper Riverdale Road, nigga. 330 Arrowhead Boulevard, nigga. Holla South, nigga. Holla Manor, nigga. My first spot, I seen 10,000, nigga. Really had them 10x10, them 1 to 5x10. Nigga really had slabs in they mouth, nigga. Bombs in they nuts, nigga. On God, nigga, ain't got shit to prove, nigga. I been a king, fuck a crown. I remember late nights feeling hunger pains, rapping bricks of cocaine. Trapaholics Mixtape.